tank and a 105 millimeter tank.
It's 155.
It's a metal casing that looks like an ordinary artillery round, and inside it's filled with tiny pellets, and the pellets spread out. It's somewhat like a super enlarged shotgun shell. And like, they're very terrible things to get hit with. They're blunt, and they're made to be that way because they do a lot more damage. It's a very terrible weapon. Our tank outfit in my squadron got a little bit of honor, or whatever you want to call it, because at one time they were ambushed during a road convoy, and they closed their tanks up and opened up on each other with beehive rounds, thereby knocking the Viet Cong off and not damaging themselves. You mean in direct fire with our howitzers? Not with the howitzers, no. It was done sporadically with small arms, but not with the howitzers.
Any other questions? Could I answer that question, if you don't mind? Free fire zone is set up, established at the United States command levels, and then put out to the province chiefs, the South Vietnamese province chiefs, and it's up to them to warn anyone in the area that that area has been designated a free fire zone. Of course, this doesn't take into account the fact that people, after they have been originally warned, may drift in from other areas or may drift back to that area if they have gone to the city or some other way, some other place. A free fire zone is just what it says. You are at any time and with any weapon available allowed to fire into that area without getting clearance, without worrying about who's in the area.
I'd like to know if anybody had ever gathered any information about the strategy that the NLF and the NVA employed to counteract the card psychology, you know, like the cards of dead bodies. Was any evidence about fighting that, you know, the minds of the people?
Well, I really don't know. I don't have the answer to that. I don't know if they did counteract it, and if they did, how they did. I just can't answer that question. I don't know.
It'd be very hard.
Like if they would take a card, you know, and just in an attempt to defy what it meant, they would, you know, destroy it or something like that.
I really believe that, you know, a lot of the NVA and VC from, you know, in my opinion, were also Buddhists, and they were scared to death of this card, too. I mean, that was the whole reason for putting it on the body, because we knew they would be afraid to come near the body, first of all, and that it was a psychological effect, you know? This was another way of throwing a scare into them. And we not only put them on bodies, we put them in bunkers and stuff. If we came across bunkers that were still usable, and we didn't have time to destroy them or something, and we thought maybe they would come back to the bunkers after we left, we'd throw one of these cards in there, and we're pretty sure they wouldn't use that bunker. A lot of times, we didn't have proof that they wouldn't use it after that, would not use it after that, but we felt pretty sure that they wouldn't use a bunker then because of, you know, the significance of this card.
I'm sorry, we've run out of time. I've just been notified. I can't take any more questions. I'd like to announce that all members of the Philadelphia chapter, VVAW. There's a very important meeting immediately following this panel in the veterans' room. Has to deal with organizational matters. So if you'd all go back there, VVAW members, Philadelphia chapter. Thank you.
name is Richard Altenberger. Our next panel will be about what the war has done to the North Vietnamese people. I myself served with the 173rd Airborne Brigade in Vietnam from 1965 to 1966. Our two speakers this afternoon are Mrs. Kay Camp, President of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, and Ms. Pat Samuel, Director of the Program in Action for WIL. Our first speaker will be Mrs. Camp.
Thank you, Rich. We would like to take this opportunity to pay our respects to the Viet vets for their heroic anti-hero role that they're playing, for the courage and the strength of character that we imagine it must take to relive the horrors they've been through when it would be so easy just to chuck it all, and to triumph over the big brainwash to which they have been subjected, and probably at the risk, in some cases, the actual suffering of alienation from family and old friends, to tell the truth, particularly to a public that doesn't really want to hear all this. We're emotional wrecks after only 2 weeks in North and South Vietnam, so I can imagine what it must be like for them. It's very hard to speak about these unspeakable crimes. We went as part of a six-woman team from the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom to North and South Vietnam. And we'll just describe some of the information we met in Hanoi and in the provinces. We worked out a program with the Women's Union, of whom we were guests, and said that we wanted to see sites of destruction and meet victims of the bombardments and so forth. We did visit a museum of weaponry. We went to two provinces. We met for a whole day with their Commission of Inquiry into U.S. War Crimes, and we did meet some of the victims of these U.S. policies. We went to two small provinces, seeing frequently piles of rubble along the way, and every bridge we crossed was being repaired, it seemed. We visited sites of churches and pagodas that had been bombed, factories, villages, homes. Factories, yeah. Much of the destruction has been repaired and is being repaired, but just from the glimpse we saw, we were amazed at the extent and the enormity of it, particularly since we had been told throughout the Johnson and Nixon years that we were only bombing military targets. It's hard to... I haven't really quoted statistics. We were given statistics. And I don't believe the U.S. statistics, war crime statistics. I know some of the pressures that statisticians are under in compiling these. And I'm not going to say that these figures that we were given are absolute. But we were told that 137 hospitals in North Vietnam were destroyed in the bombings. 1,500 schools were attacked. That of 30 provincial capitals, 26 were attacked. That 60% of the villages in all of North Vietnam were attacked. That of 68 state farms, 66 were attacked. That no bridges remained intact. That 475 churches and about 420 pagodas were bombed, destroyed, other museums, and so forth. We saw some of the churches. We visited a nunnery convent in which five nuns were killed and talked with the Mother Superior. This was in a province where there had been 60,000 Catholics, 10,000 of whom went south when they were told that they would receive a rice field and a buffalo if they went south, but if they stayed in the north, they would receive an A-bomb. And we were also told that these bombings were very systematically planned. I find this very hard to believe myself, but they do believe that a coastal village, for instance, which was bombed, would be bombed during the dusk hours when the fishermen were returning and the families were meeting them on the beaches. With anti-personnel weapons, they would be bombed. That schools were bombed when the children had gathered and were having their lessons. Even that churches and pagodas were bombed on Sundays when the people were in them, attending them, services. That the whole purpose was to strike at the human as well as the economic potential, at the human spirit of the people. Of course, the most intensive period was from 65 through 68, October 68, but we learned of the extent of the bombing in North Vietnam since then. Thousands of intensified reconnaissance plane activity, always accompanied by escort fighter bombers, one or two. That many bombs were directed against anti-aircraft installations, that there were 322, my notes say here, B-52 attacks along the border, all of this in 1970. And that during the raid in November 21st, 1970, in conjunction with the raid on the Sante camp, that 49 persons were killed, that phosphorus bombs were dropped, and so forth. I won't go into the weaponry because Pat Samuel will tell you about that. Pat, why don't you do that now?
While we were there, we were taken to a museum which they are building. They have some displays in it already, and they hope to have more. This is a museum devoted to the weapons used by the United States in the war, and it documents, both with actual exhibits of weapons, pictures, maps, charts, what the United States has done to Vietnam, North and South. We also talked to the Commission of Inquiry into U.S. War Crimes, where we were given quite a lengthy explanation of the weapons used by the United States. Although President Johnson and Nixon said that the bombing of North Vietnam was limited to military targets, this obviously is not true based on the weapons that we saw, because we were shown lots of different anti-personnel weapons. And for those of you not familiar with the Army, any personnel weapons are absolutely useless for destroying military targets such as bridges, trains, supply depots, and so on. The only thing they do is destroy people. They had a full range of weapons, beginning with the pineapple bomb, which was first used by the United States over North Vietnam in 1965. The pineapple bomb got its name because it looks like a pineapple. It's a small, about this big, and if it lands in an upright position, it explodes and about 250 pellets come out. But if it lands on its side or at an angle, we were told it would not explode. And so this was considered a rather ineffective bomb, and the next anti-personnel weapon used was the guava bomb. It's spherical in shape, about the size of a baseball, and it explodes no matter what angle it lands at, and it has about 300 pellets. And then there was an orange bomb, again because it looks like an orange, and that's a fragmentation bomb. And then the improved orange bomb. You see, these earlier weapons, when they exploded, and either the pellets or the fragments came out, of course, obviously these fragments come out at different angles. And in the earlier weapons, it was found that the distribution range was that 30% of the fragments went off at a very low angle. And so they would just hit the average adult between his feet and his thigh. Another 30% went out at a slightly higher angle, and they would hit the average adult between the thigh and the chest. And the remaining 30% went out at a very high angle, and they would hit you in the upper chest and the head. Well, obviously, the 30% that just hit you around the knee would not tend to be very fatal. So in the improved orange bomb, the distribution was changed so that fewer fragments went out at the low angle and more fragments went out at a higher angle where they would hit an adult in the chest or head. They also showed us the spider bomb, which looks rather like a baseball, except it has 8 holes in it. And out of each of these holes comes a spring. And the spring is attached to the bomb by 8 yards of thread. And the North Vietnamese told us that these spider bombs were usually dropped at the end of a major bombing raid, so that when people came out to begin rescuing the wounded in the cleanup work, they would trip over these threads. Then the bomb would explode and they would be killed or get injured. And they showed us the latest anti-personnel weapon developed by the United States. We saw one that had a manufacturer's date stamped on it of June 1970. And they said that these bombs were first used in the November raid in 1970. And these are shaped rather like missiles, and they're about 8 or 10 inches long. And they can penetrate a wall 1 yard thick. And then they explode. So with these latest anti-personnel weapons, it's possible to injure the people who are inside the shelters. All these various anti-personnel weapons come in large bombs. You collect up a large number, say, of orange bombs or guava bombs or whatever, and they're dropped out of the plane in great big bombs known as mother bombs. We saw some of these mother bombs in the museum where they had them collected. These weapons are particularly horrible because they do hurt the people, and I think that they do go to show that the bombing in North Vietnam was clearly not limited to military targets.
We'd like to describe our meetings with some of the victims of the bombing. Phan Thi Thiem was 22 years old. He was wounded on March 28, 1970 in Gay An province. He says, I'm with 4 friends. We heard the planes and hid in the shelter. I had been working in a state store and teaching evening classes. The planes dropped smoke bombs, then pellet bombs. 2 fell at the shelter door and wounded two people. I'm 3rd from the door. 1 died on the spot with a pellet in the heart. The 2nd received many in the chest and died 8 hours later. Another bomb through the top of the shelter, and he displayed the back of his neck, the shoulders, and the hip all scarred. I fell unconscious. Then they dropped napalm. strong heat, have to crawl through burning house to hospital. Can't use right arm, painful, no sensation in lower arm, cannot grasp. The pellets have been removed, but the shoulder still has some. One is lodged near the spine. The pellets may move, could perforate arteries and damage nerves. Bui Van Vaught, 20 years old, was wounded on March 14, 1970 in Da Nang. He was burned with phosphorus bombs. I am working as a peasant. The guns shell our village. I reach the shelters. Five planes are circling. I try to find a shelter. My arms and legs are badly burned. Brought to Da Nang Hospital. On the way, met with American soldiers who shot the people carrying me, cut off heads of some wounded, cut with sword the back of my neck. I assume he means bayonet. They used a hand to see if I'm dead. I remain immobile. Was left for a day. Cadres finally brought me to NLF Hospital, where I received treatment and was sent to North Vietnam for more treatment. We talked also with a young woman, now 33, who had come north from the south, where she had spent many years as a political prisoner. Pat's notes say five, mine say seven. But the point is that she refused to renounce her political beliefs and was transferred from prison to prison many times, was beaten to the point or to unconsciousness several times, was finally released when she was near death, brought to North Vietnam, where she is recovering and learning to walk again. One more is a story told by a little girl who is now 12, was 9 or 10 at the time. She was living in one of the northern provinces of South Vietnam with her mother and her little sister in a village. She had been a schoolgirl until the American soldiers came into their vicinity. On one day, they came to her village and lined up the people on the outskirts of the village and shot them. And in order to dispose of the bodies, the account goes, that they placed the bodies between the roots, the above ground part of the roots of large trees, and covered them with rice hay and lit the hay so that bodies and roots would be charred together. And this happened again in the center of the village where the people were round up who were eating lunch and shot and disposed of. And then they came to her edge of the village where the same event occurred, and she could hear her mother crying, "My God, they are killing my children." And she was the first to fall, she and her baby sister, and her mother fell on top of her. And when the soldiers came to burn the bodies with the rice hay, she was saved, perhaps because the hay was so soaked with blood that it wouldn't burn. She was found a day or two later by an uncle who later sent her to North Vietnam. Pat.
Okay. One of the things that the Commission of Inquiry talked most about was the use of chemical weapons in South Vietnam, herbicides and defoliants. I'm not going to discuss that because it is in a later panel, but we did meet with two women born and raised in South Vietnam who had lived in villages that were sprayed by these herbicides and defoliants. At the time, they were 2 months pregnant. They came north to have their babies, and they brought them into the room to show them to us. The first mother picked her baby up and held him up on the table for us. It was a pretty fat, husky-looking baby to me. But then they pointed out that he had 6 toes. They also pointed out that although he was 18 months old, his mother was holding him up because he could not stand up or sit up by himself. He couldn't walk or talk, and he was severely mentally retarded. The second mother then brought out her baby, and that one didn't need any technical explanation because this baby girl had a head only half the size of a normal baby's head. We did have a chance to meet with Prime Minister Pham Van Dong of North Vietnam. And that was at the end of our visit, and so he knew that we had seen and heard the things that we have related to you. He knew that the United States had done a lot of damage to Vietnam, and he pointed out that they expected more to come, because he said the Vietnamization policy is failing, and since Nixon will not withdraw American troops, he will be forced to escalate. They didn't know what form the escalation might take, whether it would be invasion of North Vietnam, a resumption of the bombing, a bombing of the dikes and Haiphong Harbor, or possibly even nuclear weapons. But he pointed out that the people were very vigilant and they were prepared. They had suffered a lot from the United States, and they were prepared to suffer a lot more. But they were not going to give up. They thought that the justice was on their side, that they were fighting for a very simple and elementary principle, Vietnam for the Vietnamese. And they intended to continue fighting for that no matter what the United States tried to do to them.
I would just like to say in closing that last week we met with a senior staff member of the National Security Council to tell him of our findings and our trip and to discuss the major issue of the war with them. And among the things we discussed was the testimony of the Winter Soldiers. We asked whether they had read it, and they said no, they hadn't. They had heard of it and they felt that it lacked credibility. That's a quote. Coming from the source of the big official lie, that is, would be amusing if it were not so tragic. We personally feel that the testimony of the Winter Soldiers, together with the information coming out of the Cali trial and so forth, and the information of a few courageous independent newsmen, will make a difference and will, in fact, help bring about a tremendous revulsion against war, particularly this war, on the part of the American people, and help us all end it. Thank you very much.
Does anyone have any questions? Does anyone have any questions? That concludes this panel. Thank you. Next panel will start at 2:45. Thank you.
May I just say that since Pat wasn't introduced, this is Pat Samuel, who is Program and Action Director for the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom.
Yes, I'm Could I have your attention, please? Mr. Cohen is here for the... would like to say a few words to the audience.
To wish the work of this two-day session, not for your sake, but for the sake of all American people and all people throughout the world, wish you well. I think it's extraordinarily important that sessions such as these be intensified, that the war issue not be permitted to die down, that we not fall for the view that the president is de-escalating. I think it's quite clear now that he's seeking every possible way to maintain a condition of war in Indochina. I think action like this in preparation for later action this spring in Washington and throughout the nation is just extraordinarily important. It's important not only from the point of view of peace, from the point of view of putting end to a criminally illegal and insane action overseas, a destructive action, a killing action, but it's also important to those of us who live in the cities to see that the enormous economic resources that are being drained away in this war are instead converted to useful, constructive purposes that improve the life of all people and that increase dignity, increase opportunities for everybody. I wish I could stay for more panels, but I'm unable to. But just go on and keep intensifying these kinds of pressures. I think it's just wonderful. Thank you very much.
Deal with chemical and biological warfare in Vietnam with the expertise of Madeline McNabb from the National Action on Research into the Military-Industrial Complex, Candy Putter with Resistance, and the veteran's testimony.
Ground, a sort of big laboratory, a critical test of American determination, brain power, or as John Wayne would say it, a test of guts. When President Kennedy and his advisors decided to commit the United States to take over the defeated French military effort to control Indochina, they understood the war, which was then only a little war, exactly in those terms. Their intention was to demonstrate in Vietnam that wars of national liberation must fail. For example, in 1963, Maxwell Taylor explained this idea in a very concrete way when he said of Vietnam, this is a quote, "Here we have a going laboratory. This has been a challenge not just for the armed services, but for several of the agencies of government, as many of them are involved in one way or another in South Vietnam. On the military side, however, we have recognized the importance of the area as a laboratory. We have had teams out there looking at the equipment requirements of this kind of guerrilla warfare. We have rotated senior officers through there, spending several weeks just to talk to people and get the feel of the operation. Not only weapons have been tested in Vietnam, but also American public opinion, both in and out of the military. Would the public and the troops put up with the kind of war that is necessary to defeat a national liberation movement in Vietnam, in Laos, then in Cambodia, or anywhere else? How much would people at home swallow from the 6 o'clock news? How much would they pay in taxes? How many sons would they send? Would the sons go fight and then come back home and go about their business untroubled? One of the weapons tested in Vietnam is herbicides. Before the war, herbicides were just chemicals that killed weeds, but when used militarily to fight against a people's war, herbicides are poisons to kill the food crops and destroy the forests. One problem in talking about herbicides is that their use in warfare and in the concentrations repeatedly sprayed over the countryside in Vietnam has never been tried before, and no one can say what all the results of this particular experiment will be. For example, it is a fact that in some areas sprayed, no regrowth of any vegetation was found to occur up to 6 years after the spraying. How long will it take such areas to recover? According to a recent study of a team of scientists with the American Association for the Advancement of Science, about 35% of the dense jungle, which makes up half of South Vietnam's forest land, has been defoliated. Whether this jungle will grow back eventually, or whether it will be permanently crowded out by bamboo and grasses, is not known. The scientists call the food denial program a failure because nearly all of the food destroyed, they estimated about 95%, would have been consumed not by the liberation fighters, but by civilians, particularly the Montagnards of the Central Highlands. Enough food to feed 600,000 people a year has been destroyed, according to an estimate made for this team by specialists on Vietnam in the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The effects of soil erosion resulting from the spraying cannot yet be guessed at, nor is it known what the effects of defoliation of the jungle area will have on the animal population, or on the fish or the crustaceans like shrimp. Though one scientist ventured the possibility that the only animals to thrive in a defoliated area may be termites. It is a fact that 2,4-5-T has been shown to cause birth defects in laboratory mice, and that the herbicide Agent Orange contains 2,4-5-T, and that most of the defoliation in Vietnam has been done by Agent Orange, about 90% of it. Though the president announced last April that Agent Orange would no longer be used in Vietnam, the New York Times reported its use in two northern provinces of South Vietnam throughout last summer. Another substance, which makes up 80% of the Agent White herbicide, has also been implicated in producing birth defects in mice and rats in laboratory conditions. When Agent Orange was banned, Agent Weiss replaced it as the main herbicidal agent to spray the forests, which make up about two-thirds of the land area. The effect on the people who live in the sprayed areas and eat the fresh fish from rivers which filter through the defoliated forests is not known. Whether or not herbicides enter the food chain is not known. Whether or not these substances have already caused Vietnamese babies to be born dead or malformed is not known. And I speak there in the Western sense. The Saigon Ministry of Health classified their files on malformed babies secret in 1969. According to Thomas Whiteside, author of a book on defoliation, since 1962, the defoliation operations have covered almost 5 million acres, an area equivalent to about 12% of the entire territory of South Vietnam, and about the size of the state of Massachusetts. And that statement was made more than a year ago. Research on defoliation has been done at Princeton and the Davis campus of the University of California. Production of herbicides used in Indochina has been done by the following list of U.S. companies. They're sort of household names: Monsanto, Diamond Shamrock, Dow Chemical, Thompson Chemical in St. Louis, Thompson Hayward Chemical Company, Hercules, Uniroyal, Acil Chemical Company. 4 years ago, the philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre tried to answer the question, is the United States guilty of the crime of genocide according to international law? After hearing testimony from many witnesses at the International War Crimes Tribunal called by Bertrand Russell and available to us an important book called Against the Crime of Silence, Sartre points out that the word genocide is new, coined between the two world wars, but the thing is as old as mankind. He went on to make an important point about the particular relationship between the United States and the countries of Indochina, and I'm quoting briefly. We find once again almost the same pattern of war as the one that Ho Chi Minh fought against the French, except that at first the American government declared that it was only sending its troops out of generosity to fulfill its obligations to an ally. That is the outward appearance. But looking deeper, these two successive wars are essentially different in character. The United States, unlike France, has no economic interests in Vietnam. American firms have made some investments, but not so much that they couldn't be sacrificed if necessary, without troubling the American nation as a whole or really hurting the monopolies. Moreover, since the U.S. government is not waging the war for reasons of directly economic nature, there is nothing to stop it from ending this war by the ultimate tactic, in other words, by genocide. This is not to say that this is proof that the United States does in fact envision genocide, but simply that nothing prevents the U.S. from envisioning it. Now we have a newer word, ecocide, which means the premeditated assault of a nation and its resources against the individuals, cultural and biological fabric of another country and its environs. Sartre's point that the United States has all too little to lose in Indochina also applies to the rice, timber, rubber trees, sweet potatoes, fruits and other vegetables, fish, animals, and future generations of Indochinese people already damaged or potentially affected by the weed killer experiment. Let me quote briefly from a new book about this newer war crime, ecocide. It's a very good book. It's called Ecocide in Indochina by Barry Weisberg and is just out. The ecosystem of Southeast Asia is one organic fabric which all living things are tied together by an infinite number of interdependent strands. The mountains, rivers, jungles, plants, animals, and human society of this region form a single community. The extent to which we have tampered with this community, the extent to which reconstruction is possible, this is not known. But any reasonable estimate must conclude that never before in the history of mankind has such magnitude of destruction been wrought upon any people at any time in any single place. Herbicides, free fire zones, anti-personnel and fragmentation bombs, napalm, urbanization, food denial programs, all together form an unprecedented strategy of counterinsurgency warfare. The current American destruction of Southeast Asia represents a new and unprecedented strategy aimed not merely at the destruction of an enemy, his territory, a food crop, or a culture, but of an entire ecosystem. This is ecocide. The two critical agents of this new strategy are chemical and biological warfare, primarily the use of herbicides known as defoliants, and the saturation bombardment of people and landscape with high explosives. The recent White House announcement that defoliation would be limited to remote, unpopulated areas is less than reassuring, since the Pentagon has always contended that it sprays only remote, unpopulated areas. By a vote of 80-3, the United Nations General Assembly in December 1969 declared that herbicides are included in the international ban on chemical warfare in the Geneva Protocol of 1925. The Nixon administration opposes this definition and is now asking Congress to approve the protocol with the understanding that herbicides are not included. Briefly, to quote Ed Herman's book, Atrocities in Vietnam, deliberate and large-scale food destruction is also a clear violation of numerous articles of the Hague Convention of 1907, the Washington Conference of 1922-23, and the Nuremberg Code. The first use of gas in warfare is also understood by the UN General Assembly to be included under the 1925 Geneva Protocol. Despite an intensive lobbying drive, the United States could get only Portugal and Australia to vote with it. Again, numerous articles in the Hague Convention of 1907 pertain, outlawing such actions as war as to employ poison or poisoned weapons, to employ arms, projectiles, or any material calculated to cause unnecessary suffering. These passages also apply to napalm and phosphorus, which some people will mention. According to an Associated Press report in January 3, 1970, besides defoliants, more than 7,000 tons of gas has been used in the war between 1964 and 1969. Gases are riot control agents, the administration says, and are used to save lives. The escalatory nature of the term riot control agent is illustrated by the fact that it includes agents ranging from the tear gas CN to CS and the more powerful lung agent CS2. Even such agents as Atomsite DM, which has been used in Vietnam, are classified as riot control agents, even though an Army manual says that DM is not to be used in any operation where deaths are not acceptable. Even the tear and lung gases, which do not kill their victims directly, except in very heavy concentrations, or when used on the young or sick, are used to drive the enemy into the open, where he will be killed by aircraft or gunfire. This use is confirmed by sources as divergent as widespread newspaper accounts, firsthand accounts of soldiers in Vietnam, and even Army magazine itself, which stated, CS has proved particularly effective in Vietnam in flushing the enemy out of bunkers preceding high explosive fire or infantry assaults. Dean Rusk stated when CS was first used in Vietnam that it would only be used for humanitarian purposes in situations analogous to riot control and not in ordinary military operations. And the Pentagon has stated on numerous occasions that it is used only, quote, to save lives. The military later changed this to read to save U.S. and allied lives and went on to explain that it would do so by serving as an effective combat weapon. Now, I have a series of statements from doctors, from people who fought, and so on, about the military uses of gas. Perhaps we can go back to that if we feel we have time later. I'll skip them right now so other people can get to talk. However novel the latest in gas weaponry may be, the barbaric morality behind its use isn't so new. I'd like to quote from the Congressional Record briefly from a speech from a senator from our state, Mr. Reed, in a discussion of the gas warfare and the Geneva Protocol in 1926. Exactly the same arguments were being used then. This treaty would stop us from using the gas against the next savage race which we find ourselves at war and would compel us to blow them up or stab them with bayonets or riddle them and sprinkle them with shrapnel or puncture them with machine gun bullets instead of blinding them for an hour or so until we could disarm them. That goes on for a while, but you get the gist of it. Other chemical weapons used by the United States in Indochina are white phosphorus and napalm. These are not only the incendiary weapons. These are not the only incendiary weapons. Magnesium, thermite, and thermate are among some others. But the war has made these two substances internationally notorious. Napalm was developed during World War II. The first successful napalm detonations were carried out on a Harvard University games field and behind the football stadium. Napalm was the principal agent used in the incendiary raids on Japanese cities and caused far more deaths than the atomic attacks in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. In Korea, huge amounts of napalm was used. At the height of the war, its use exceeded 250,000 pounds a day. The Defense Department is not eager to reveal how much napalm has been dropped in Indochina. An incomplete report in June of 1969 stated that 100,000 tons had been dropped, mostly in southern Vietnam, but since then the use of napalm has risen sharply. Napalm has two effects, asphyxiation and burns which are likely to be deep and extensive. Officially, napalm is said to be used only against enemy troops. So many firsthand reports of its use against entire villages exist that this claim need not be taken very seriously. Napalm is also used to burn rice fields. Since white phosphorus is less familiar than napalm to us civilians, let me give a brief example of its use. Again, the official word is that phosphorus is used to produce a white smoke for aerial marking. Although U.S. Army manual also states that white phosphorus has incendiary and anti-personnel effects. Let me just quote a sentence from the Journal of American Medical Association of January 2, 1967, from an article on wounding power of the missiles used in the Republic of Vietnam. Quote, there has been a variety of wounds, including those caused by the white phosphorus grenade, which adds the problem of continuing tissue destruction from the burning phosphorus until all the phosphorus is removed. We're familiar enough with the pictures of children, women, and elderly people who've been hit by incendiary weapons. Some of these photos are on the wall. These photos speak better than I can about the effects of these weapons, which have proven so useful to what the United States is doing to the people and land of Indochina. NARMIC will be making up a list of the companies which produce the incendiaries as part of our statement to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on the Geneva Protocol. How far will the United States go in all this? If the limits of international law have long since been exceeded, how far will this experiment be pushed? What new and more terrible weapons will be designed and used? What new lies told to the American people? I think Sartre was right in his answer to this question, quoting again from his statement on genocide. In October 1966, General Westmoreland said, "We are fighting the war in Vietnam to show that guerrilla warfare does not pay. To show whom? The Vietnamese? That would be very surprising. Must so many human lives and so much money be wasted merely to teach a lesson to a nation of poor peasants thousands of miles away from San Francisco? And in particular, what need was there to attack them, to provoke them into fighting, and subsequently to go about crushing them, when the big American companies have only negligible interests in Vietnam?" Westmoreland's statement has to be filled in. The Americans want to show others that guerrilla war does not pay. They want to show all the oppressed and exploited nations that might be tempted to shake off the American yoke by launching a people's war, at first against their own pseudo-governments and the army, and then against the U.S. Special Forces, and finally against the GIs. In short, they want to show Latin America, first of all, and more generally all of the Third World. To Che Guevara, who said, "We need several Vietnams," the American government answers, "They will all be crushed the way we are crushing the first." By means of this warning, 6% of mankind hopes to succeed in controlling the other 94% at a reasonably low cost in money and effort. Of course, it would be preferable, for propaganda purposes, if the Vietnamese would submit before being exterminated. But it is not certain the situation wouldn't be clearer if Vietnam were wiped off the map. If these peasants did not weaken for an instant, and if the price they pay for their heroism is inevitable death, the guerrillas of the future would be all the more discouraged. For this reason, as the American government very well knows, the current genocide is conceived as an answer to people's war and perpetrated in Vietnam not against the Vietnamese alone, but against humanity. The very nature of such weapons as herbicides, gases, napalm, and the incredible tonnage in bombing reflect the state of mind, the political and moral attitudes that created the war. In this experiment, the United States was politically defeated some time ago. After the recent rout in Laos, the military defeat is all too clear, too. Will the experiment be pushed further? It is consistent both with the morality of the United States in Vietnam, as well as the political and military realities, to suggest that the possibility of the use of atomic weapons is now under serious consideration. We know from the testimony of Vietnam veterans that non-tactical nuclear weapons are in Vietnam now, and men have been trained in their use. In 1968, there were 5,500 weapons in the Southeast Asian area, mostly on carriers and some in Korea. The idea of the use of these weapons has been introduced to a war-weary American public in the New York Times. I quote C.L. Sulzberger on November 15th. "Limited commitment to conventional defenses are seen as increasingly outmoded, and yet total warfare is a dreadful absurdity. Consequently, the search focuses on a third solution, between impossible nuclear disaster and unsuccessful conventional warfare. The answer may well lie in the field of truly tactical atomic weapons." In line with the United States government's propaganda that what is going on is not a revolution or a civil war, but an invasion of one country, North Vietnam, into another country, South Vietnam, there have been attempts to physically barricade the North and the South, for example, the near ludicrous McNamara Line. The possibility of creating a zone of nuclear contamination beneath the DMZ may sound like a reasonable move to the Pentagon. If so, it could explain the evacuation in the last months of 1970 of from 1 to 3 million people in the 5 northern provinces of the South, the statistics vary, and the plans announced in the January 11th New York Times to move up to 1 million more. The use of atomic weapons in Vietnam would not mark a new course for the United States, but only an extension of the one now pursued, and that is exactly the problem. As we demand peace, let's remember that the Pentagon may well twist those demands into pressures for a quick and total victory. We must make clear that the peoples of Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia have won many times over their wars for national independence, and this reality must be recognized by the complete withdrawal of American bases, ships, planes, and troops from their homelands. Joe, that's all I have to say.
At this time, we will now have a slideshow on defoliants. The slides were captured from the United States Air Force.
this line as you speak, and then we'll get into it. What does your testimony deal with?
While we're setting up, we'll be talking about the effects of the defoliants on the Vietnamese people as well as the ground. It's more pronounced on the Vietnamese, but people forget that there's also Americans on the ground too, and a lot of people come up and ask me, and ask many of our brothers when we're standing on the corner, you can't be Vietnam veterans, you have too much hair on your face. Well, perhaps the defoliants cause the growth on our face, so...
Power might have been turned off when I looked at the lights this morning.
Free light show.
These slides were lent to me by somebody in New York who was with the U.S. Air Force procurement office, and he procured the slides. This is a C-130, which is an Air Force plane used for transportation in Vietnam. You'll note it has Vietnamese insignia on it. The significance of this is that in some of these other slides, you'll see defoliation with the same kind of aircraft. The defoliant they're using is a combination of agents blue, orange, or white. Agent Orange supposedly was, the use of Agent Orange was discontinued in 1970 because of a number of reports about its toxicity and especially about its teratogenic effects, meaning fetal deforming effects. The Vietnamese collect their drinking water in drains, and some of this water drains off trees. You know, this country has an enormous amount of foliage. So these chemicals spread on the trees, and then it rains, and then it gets into their drinking water. The same thing, that's a C-130. This shows a little clearer the markings. That's a Vietnamese Air Force marking. It's hard to see it. The picture isn't very good, but that whole area at the top is deforested, if you can see it. You can see what it looks like when the planes are flying overhead, the defoliation, and the top are just tree stumps. The same kind of slide, defoliation in the bottom. These are Air Force films. Defoliation, planes flying over a forested area, and the effects of it. This is theoretically advertisement for how effective they are. They're defoliating over an area that's already been defoliated. I think this was Dave's slide.